These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. They are produced by the Teaching Company. The Great Courses cover a broad array of university-level disciplines. The lectures in each course are either 30 or 45 minutes long. By listening for less than an hour a day, you can finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalog or website and imagine how much you could learn if you spent just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the best college classrooms in the world. The lecturers are university professors carefully selected by the Teaching Company and its customers for intellectual distinction and teaching excellence. These lectures are titled The Renaissance, the Reformation, and the Rise of Nations, Part 1. The lecturer is Professor Andrew C. Fix. Dr. Fix is the Charles A. Dana Professor of History at Lafayette College in Easton, Pennsylvania, where he has been teaching for over 15 years. He received his bachelor's degree in history and philosophy from Wake Forest University and went on to earn his master's degree and his doctorate in history from Indiana University at Bloomington. Prior to teaching at Lafayette College, Professor Fix held a Fulbright Fellowship and a Woodrow Wilson Fellowship. Dr. Fix has written or edited three books, including Prophecy and Reason, The Dutch Collegians in the Early Enlightenment, and Fallen Angels, Balthasar Becker, Spirit Belief, and Confessionalism in the 17th Century Dutch Republic. Professor Fix is the recipient of the Jones Award for Superior Teaching and Excellence of Scholarship and the Van Artstelen Award for Scholarship. Professor Fix prepared the course guide that comes with these lectures. The course guide includes a detailed outline of each lecture, a glossary, biographical notes, and a bibliography. To get the most out of this course, you may find it useful to follow along with the outlines or review them before or after each lecture. Lecture 1, Crisis of the 14th Century.
Welcome to this course on the Renaissance, the Reformation, and the Rise of Nations. I'm Andrew Fix from Lafayette College in Easton, Pennsylvania, and I'll be presenting this course to you. The course basically covers what we call the early modern period of European history, which starts around 1348 with the bubonic plague and runs to about 1715. This is a particularly interesting period of European history because it's a major transitional period in which the Middle Ages pretty much comes to an end, and we see the beginnings, the early beginnings, of what's going to be the modern European social, political, and economic structure. And today we're going to be starting with the 14th century and what I call the crisis of the 14th century, because this really is a place where you see the whole early modern period starting. The 14th century is a period of tremendous upheaval and tremendous crisis in European history. And in this period, you see almost all the major trends of the Middle Ages, especially the High Middle Ages, being reversed. And 100 years of disaster occurs, which will set up the Renaissance, the rebirth period, and will move us on into the Reformation and the 17th century. So we'll start out by taking a look at the 14th century crisis. And what I want to do to begin with is just sum up some ways in which the 14th century was really dramatically different from the High Middle Ages, meaning the 12th, 13th century, the end of the Middle Ages. For one thing, the population situation is much different. The High Middle Ages was a period of population growth, population expansion. In fact, in many ways, Europe was overpopulated in the 13th century. The 14th century becomes a period of population decline for reasons that you'll see in a few minutes. Disastrous, catastrophic population decline, which has a major effect on almost every other aspect of European life. Secondly, the High Middle Ages had been a period of economic expansion, economic prosperity for the most part, and the 14th century, because of the demographic disaster, becomes a period of economic depression, economic decline, economic downturn in a major way. Thirdly, politically speaking, the High Middle Ages had been a period of relative political stability, with fairly strong feudal monarchies in England, France, and other countries, and a fairly stable social political situation that all completely melts down in the 14th century into a period of war, chaos, turmoil, revolt, just a disastrous political situation and social situation. And finally, the 13th century, the High Middle Ages, had been a period of a very powerful Catholic Church, which really controlled religious life. And in the 14th century, the Church also begins to crumble as a result of the Great Schism, the Babylonian captivity, various corruptions in the Church. So in this particular lecture, we're going to be looking at the first parts of these trend reversals. We're going to be looking, first of all, at the demographic disaster, demographic collapse, population collapse, and we're going to be looking at the political turmoil and chaos. But we'll start out with the change, which really is at the root of all these other changes, and that is the population decline, or what we really should call a demographic disaster of unparalleled proportions. And most people probably realize this is a result of the bubonic plague, but actually it started before the plague. The population decline did, in fact, start as early as 1315. And this has to do with the fact that in the 13th century, Europe had become so populated that they had to begin planting every scrap of land they had in food crops just to have enough food to feed the population. And that's okay as long as you can plant, you know, basically good, fertile land. But the population had reached the level where they also had to plant what we call marginal land, which is land which is not really very good for raising crops, rocky, sandy soil, sometimes swampy and too damp. And the problem with this is that in a very good year, with good weather, this land might produce some food. But when the weather turns bad, even slightly bad, the marginal lands are going to fail, the crops won't come in, and the population, depending on those crops, will die. That's exactly what happens starting in 1315, and in a whole succession of years after that, in 1316, 1317, again in 1339, 1340, bad weather, for example, too much rain in the springtime, too much rain in the summer, early frosts, all these things combine to cause the marginal lands to collapse, and people who were dependent on that started to starve. And so that really is the beginning of the population decline, the demographic decline, this situation with the starvation of the people depending on the marginal lands. As the marginal lands failed, people who were starving, first of all, ate their grain reserves. Most towns in the Middle Ages had small grain reserves for such emergencies, but they were easily and quickly eaten up. And then people started eating the seeds they were going to use to plant the next year, which of course just establishes a vicious cycle where now they won't have anything to plant the next year. So the population decline actually starts a good time before the plague itself strikes. But of course, the huge impact is the bubonic plague or the Black Death, which arrives in Europe in 1347, 1348. And that's going to be the majority of our look in this, our focus in this lecture. Plague arrives in Europe on a merchant ship traveling from Crimea in Central Asia, which docks at Messina in Sicily in 1347. Most of the crew of this merchant ship is already sick, and the people at Messina don't really want to let the ship come in and dock, but they do let it come in and dock, and they take off the sick sailors. They don't know what's wrong with them. They don't know what the disease is. And after the sailors are off the ship, the other crew on ships at that time also comes off, and those are the rats. The rats disembark from the ships and spread out through the town of Messina. And these rats carry fleas, which is not unusual because all rats carry fleas, but these particular fleas have in their stomach the bacterium for bubonic plague. And that's how the plague begins to strike. As the rats fan out through the town, the fleas jump off the rats, jump onto people, bite people, and one flea bite is enough to transmit the bubonic plague to a person. So the bubonic plague starts to spread really, really fast throughout Messina and throughout all Sicily in 1347-48. There's no biological resistance in the population because there hadn't been plague in Europe since the 5th century. And so the plague becomes quickly an epidemic, but really a pandemic, meaning it attacks everywhere, almost without exception. It spreads north into Europe. It attacks almost every place with a few exceptions we don't really understand, but it goes almost everywhere. As well as being epidemic, it's also endemic, which means it gets into the population and attacks, and then it'll appear to be gone for a while, but then it will come back. And it comes back repeatedly. For example, the city of Barcelona in Spain was hit by the first plague in 1347, hit again in 1351, again in 1362, again in 1363, again in 1371, again in 1397, and that's just the 14th century. It goes on for several centuries after that. Now, there actually wasn't just one kind of plague. There were two kinds of plague. The famous kind, the bubonic plague, is called that because people who get it get these big black swellings called buboes on their bodies, which are filled with pus and just look really terrible and eventually kind of just eats the person apart. But oddly enough, it wasn't that version of the plague which spread as fast. The other version was known as pneumonic plague, which is related to pneumonia because it gets down into your lungs. And it causes these same swellings, but not on the outside of your body. It causes them in your lungs and gradually eats your lungs away and you're asphyxiated. And the thing about pneumonic plague is when you just look at somebody, you can't tell they've got it. And it's spread by sneezing and coughing, the aerosol that comes out. And this is what caused the plague to spread the fastest. I mean, it spread like wildfire throughout all of Europe. Another thing about the plague that really hurt the population and the population's ability to recover is that the plague did not hit all age groups the same. You would normally expect a disease like this to hit maybe the very young, the very old, you know, the more vulnerable populations, but that's not where the plague hit. The plague hit people in midlife, say 20 to 45, meaning the childbearing population. And by killing off the childbearing population, the plague prevented the population from recovering. And this was just a second, you know, blow to the population level in Europe. Once the plague reduced it initially, the population didn't have the chance to recover. Of course, malnutrition caused by the failure of marginal lands made people weaker and more susceptible to get plague, so that also was a factor in this plague spread. Well, this was a demographic collapse of spectacular proportion. No one knows exactly how many people died of the plague, but it's estimated that between one-third and one-half of the total European population perishes in the first onslaught of the plague. It's a catastrophic population collapse, and it's one that's bound to have ripple effects throughout the whole social, economic, political organization of society. And that's exactly what you see here. The plague is a thing that sets off a much, much wider catastrophe in social, economic, and political areas. Just to give you some idea of the magnitude of this population collapse, let me give you a few estimated examples of population declines from different areas in the first 100 years of the plague. The nation of England in the first 100 years of the plague went from 3.7 million people to 2.2 million. The province of Provence in France went from 400,000 people to about 200,000 people. The city of Pistoia went from 43,000 to 14,000. In Germany, 40,000 towns and villages completely disappeared, meaning everybody died, and the town just vanished from the face of the earth. So it's a huge, huge population collapse. And this population collapse has the effect immediately of setting off economic trouble. As a matter of fact, it leads to a huge economic depression. And this depression covers all of Europe, and it lasts about 100 years. Why? Why the economic depression? Well, many reasons. The population collapse disrupts agricultural production. There aren't enough peasants left to do the agricultural labor to raise the food. And even those peasants who aren't killed in the plague, many of them stop showing up for work because they just feel like there's no point in working because they might die the next day. So that was one factor. Production was disrupted. An even more major factor was that demand collapsed. With the population collapsing, of course, demand for food collapses. When demand collapses, prices collapse. When prices collapse, agricultural profits collapse. And that means the people who own and run the big plantations or estates that grow the food go bankrupt. And here we're talking about noble owners of plantations who just can't make a living because they don't have the prices and profits anymore from their major economic activity, which is agricultural produce. So agriculture is hit really hard. There's a kind of vice that develops. The labor shortage leads to higher wages because the peasants that are left can ask for higher wages. On the other hand, the population loss, collapse of demand, means that prices and profits go down. So agricultural owners are just in an impossible situation where their wage levels are going up, their profit levels going down, and many, many just go bankrupt. Bankruptcy is very common among noble estate owners in the 14th, 15th century. Industry and trade is also caught in a similarly bad situation. The extremely high wages brought on by the population collapse pushed the prices of manufactured goods so high that most people can't afford to buy them, and that destroys sales. Of course, you know, the high wages are due to the labor shortage. Well, in the face of this situation, a lot of businessmen and estate owners went to their governments and asked the governments to freeze wages at an artificially low pre-plague level, thinking that, you know, being stabilizing wages like that would at least help the producers to get back on their feet if they didn't have to pay really high wages. And governments agree to do this. Does it help the economic situation? Well, not very much. What it actually does is lead to political chaos. It leads to revolts among workers and peasants in almost every country. Huge peasant revolt in England, we'll see, in 1381. Another one in France in 1382. In Florence, the Ciampi revolt of urban workers, 1378. This is common all across Europe. Lower classes rise up in rebellion against these wage freezes and other things. And now we're into the third stage of this crisis, the political stage. Political meltdown, turmoil, chaos, war, revolt, everything you can imagine. Well, when you talk about the political crisis, there are really about three different aspects to it we need to look at. Number one, the popular revolts, peasant worker revolts, and we'll take a closer look at some of those. Secondly, civil wars among nobles, and we'll see why that was going on in a couple of minutes. And then thirdly, long, costly international wars, which drain countries' treasuries and deprive kings of the ability to govern, basically. So we'll start out by taking a look, first of all, at the peasant revolts. These are kicked off by government efforts to freeze wages because it just enrages the peasants and workers. For the first time in history, the common person had the possibility, economically speaking, of making a better wage. And now governments are saying, no, you can't do it. And so this is a major reason that lower classes rise up in rebellion all across Europe. But there are other reasons. Noble landlords who are going bankrupt have to figure out ways to squeeze more money out of the peasant workers they've got left. Now, one of the things about the way noble estates were run is nobles weren't supposed to just arbitrarily raise the dues and fees peasants had to pay, the rents they had to pay. You couldn't just go out and say, well, today you pay more. But what nobles did instead was they started looking back through their estate books, their account books, looking back to the earlier days of the estate, and they found out that in the earlier days, you know, back in the Middle Ages and even maybe the early Middle Ages, that peasants had in fact paid higher dues and higher fees and higher rents. And that had just fallen by the wayside in the prosperous years since then. And now noble landlords go to their peasants and start to say, well, you got to pay these high fees and dues and rents again, and it's no change. You always had to pay them. It's not any kind of arbitrary increase. We're just getting back to the way things used to be and still should be. There's a second reason the peasants are enraged. A third reason is that kings and governments begin to raise taxes. And of course, the taxes fall on the lower classes. Kings need the money because it costs them more money to govern in this situation, and peasants now have to pay even higher royal taxes. So all this sets off a huge series of peasant rebellions. I'll just talk about one in detail, the English Peasant Revolt of 1381. Led by a rebellious priest by the name of John Ball, a huge peasant crowd, army actually, armed with farm implements and other things, marched back and forth across southern England, tearing up the countryside, burning, looting, causing all sorts of destruction. Finally, the peasant army marches on London and goes to the royal palace and demands to talk to the king about their grievances. Well, the king comes out on the balcony to speak to the crowd, and the crowd has confidence that the king is on their side and will try to help them. They make their demands, and their demands are extreme. Their demands are for the abolition of serfdom, for example, the abolition of feudal dues, the abolition of state taxes. I mean, we're talking about the whole feudal system coming to an end if these demands are met. The king, who happens to be a 16-year-old boy at this stage, assures the peasants that he'll do what he can, that he'll take care of these demands and that they'll be satisfied. So at that point, the peasant army retires, and instead of the king trying to, you know, meet the demands, what the king does is he musters the royal army and slaughters the peasants. So, you know, who knows how many tens of thousands, if not more, peasants die, but this doesn't stop the trouble from happening. An example of urban worker revolts occurs in Florence, and this is the famous Ciampi revolt in 1378. As you'll learn a lot more about this later in the course, Florence was a wool-producing town, and the wool industry was organized into a whole complex series of guilds from top to bottom, depending on, you know, production roles and things. And about one-third of the total population of Florence worked in the woolen cloth industry. Many different guilds doing many different jobs. At the very bottom of this scale was a guild of people known as the Ciompi. And their entire job was to take the raw wool when it came into Florence and comb out the tangles in it with a wire brush and then pass it on to somebody else for the next step in the process. So they obviously didn't make very much money doing this. They were terribly impoverished, and they were at the very bottom of the whole industrial hierarchy. These are the people who rise up in rebellion to begin with against the wage freezes in Florence. But they're soon joined by a lot of the other lesser guilds in Florence, a lot of the relatively poorer people working in the woolen cloth industry. And this revolt actually succeeds. The poor people, the lower guilds, take over the government and actually rule Florence for a couple of years. And during that time, pass a lot of measures attempting to improve the conditions of the lower classes. Now, I should mention that this itself is not unusual, because we see revolts of lower classes in most towns in Europe during this period. But Florence is a little bit unusual that the revolt succeeds so dramatically and the lower classes take charge of the government, in fact, run the government until 1381, when finally the owners of the woolen cloth industry decide to stage a lockout. They lock all the workers out of their jobs, and the workers are on the verge of starvation, and this causes them to give in, and the wealthy people, the higher guilds, come back to power, and things go back to the way they were before. But you can see, when a major city like Florence can be affected by lower class rebellions in this way, that there's a lot of unrest going on in Europe. Okay, so that's lower class rebellions. Two other kinds of political turmoil that we need to mention: civil wars among nobles, and then long, costly international wars. Civil wars among nobles, what's that all about? Well, we know that the nobles have lost a lot of money in the economic depression. They own the estates. They're the ones going bankrupt. And so they need money. Where are they going to get the extra money? There aren't that many different options for where you can get the extra money. One place you can get it is from government office. If you can get appointed to be some minister or chancellor or government official by the king, then you can draw in a pretty good income from that. Now, when I say income, you shouldn't think that these offices carry salaries, because most of them don't carry salaries. But the office holder has other ways of making money from these offices. For example, he can take gifts, he can accept tax privileges, he can get land from it, kickbacks, bribes, whatever you want to mention. It's a good source of income if you can get a government job. And so that's what nobles had their eyes on. Unfortunately, there are not nearly enough government offices to go around with for all the nobles that need them during this period. And for that reason, we see the nobles' factions breaking up and nobles fighting each other over access to government office. Another major cause for noble civil wars was that in the 14th century, for some reason that we're not entirely sure of, kings had the somewhat unusual habit of dying without leaving direct male heirs. It happens in France with the Hundred Years' War, as you'll hear in the next lecture, but happens in many other places too. And when a king dies without direct male heirs, how do you decide who's going to be the next king? Well, you go down the king's family tree and you look to see who's the next nearest male relative. In most countries, it's got to be a male relative. And if you go far enough down these family trees, there are going to be several next nearest male relatives equally closely related. And that's where civil war erupts again. Nobles choose sides, they divide up, they start to fight each other over which candidate should become the king, because if they win and their candidate becomes king, then they have access to all these government jobs and some of their economic woes might be solved. An example of this, of course, is the War of the Roses in England, which is fought actually in the 15th century, but it's an extension of the 14th century crisis. The civil war between the Armagnacs and Burgundians in France is another example. But there are many others throughout Europe that occurred like this. So we have the lower classes rising up in rebellions, both in the countryside and cities. We have noble factions fighting over access to jobs, even over access to the throne, who's going to be the next king. So the political turmoil is pretty extensive. To add to that, the 14th century becomes a period of a number of long, drawn-out, and costly international wars. The most famous of which, of course, is the Hundred Years' War, which we'll talk about in the next lecture. Why does this happen? Well, for one thing, royal governments are getting weaker and weaker. Kings also lose money in the economic depression because most medieval European kings depended on personal incomes from their lands, their own personal lands, for a substantial amount of their expenses in government, and that's not flowing in anymore. So when they start to fight these wars, and the wars drag out and become more and more costly, the kings really begin to suffer. Well, why were wars in the 14th century more costly than your typical medieval war? Couple of reasons. One reason is that the mounted knight who fought in the majority of wars in the Middle Ages has become obsolete as a fighting tool. And this is because he comes into battle on horseback wearing chainmail armor with his shield and sword and all. And he's met now with infantry wielding crossbows, sometimes English longbows, as we'll see in the next lecture. And these crossbows and longbows, the arrows or shafts from them, can penetrate chainmail armor, which means that the noble cavalry is just mowed down as it charges. And Whereas, you know, for knights, you've got to have a nobleman, he's got to buy his horse, he's got to be wealthy, he's got to be trained. For peasants wielding crossbows, it doesn't cost that much to prepare them. And so you can have a whole lot more infantry with these weapons that can destroy knights. And so knights become obsolete. That causes a major change in the way kings fight wars. Because in the Middle Ages, when the king had to fight a war, he would simply notify his nobles and he would say, well, you know, we have a war against France now, you need to come help me fight. And they would all come, they would supply their own weapons, horses, equipment at their own expense, and the king would fight the war for a certain period, and when it's over, they'd go home. Now when you can't use knights, you got to hire mercenaries. Mainly mercenary infantrymen, but also mercenary cavalry. And mercenaries, you have to pay. Not only do you have to pay them to fight, you got to equip them. You got to, if they have horses, you got to buy the horses. You got to buy all their fighting implements. And in the 14th century now, you have to buy firearms. And this is also a dramatic increase in the cost of warfare. Firearms start to be widely used by the mid to late 14th century. And here we're talking about not just field artillery, although that's the main thing, but also there were tiny handheld firearms, and later on larger musket-type things called arquebuses, which were extremely expensive. And so kings have to pay for all that. Well, how's the king get the money? He goes to his nobles, he says, well, we got to fight a war. I know you guys can't fight anymore because, you know, knights are obsolete, but you got to give me some money so I can hire my mercenaries. Well, the first couple of times the king asks, the nobles say, okay, we're not fighting, but we know we should help out, so we'll give you some money and you can hire your soldiers and you can fight. The trouble is these wars drag on so long and they're so expensive that the king has to keep going back and back and back to his nobles asking for more and more and more money. And eventually they just say, sorry, no more. We're not going to pay anymore. We've paid enough. We should be able to fight with this. And this causes animosity between the kings and nobles and drives a wedge between the two partners in government.